I'd like to call this meeting to order. We have the author here, we have a quorum, and I would also look for someone who read the minutes to approve them. Anybody bothered to read the minutes yet? Representative Sundin approves the minutes for January 20th. All in favor of that motion, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion's approved. Now, Representative Kreisha, welcome to our committee. And we're looking forward to hearing an overview of our bill.
It's a really good one, Mr. Chair.
I'm counting on it.
We can be out of here in 10 minutes if you'd like.
I'm ready.
Would you like me just to get started?
Please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, thank you, Mr. Chair, members, for hearing HF1. I believe we're going to have an overview, and then we're going to lay the bill over. And I'm excited to bring it up and talk through it. A couple of comments that I have, and there's a nice all-star lineup today of folks that are going to talk about this, and certainly folks that have a vast area of knowledge that I don't and can accent some of the holes that I may have. So I'm looking forward to that. Creating jobs and spurring economic growth is not an easy task, especially in some of our most rural areas of the state, or certainly in all areas of the state. However, because the task of economic growth is difficult, there is no excuse to throw our hands up and admit defeat. House File 1 is designed to bring together ideas and debate so that we can make sure we are trying diligently to foster growth. Our communities are counting on our passionate attempts to develop a sustained workforce and to encourage entrepreneurs to start up companies that become the jewel of the community. Our best potential to grow jobs and increase wages is to help alleviate the barriers for companies who are attempting to start up or grow in a highly global competitive environment. In Thomas Friedman's book, The World is Flat, there's an African proverb that is shared that I believe relates to the competitive nature of our businesses today. When the sun comes up in the morning, the gazelle wakes up and instinctively knows that if he doesn't start running, he will be the meal for the day for the lion. When the lion wakes up, she knows that the gazelles will be running, and therefore she must start running to catch the meal for the day. The lesson, whether you are the gazelle or the lion, you are running to stay alive. The global and highly competitive nature of our economy has created a similar environment for business owners. They are running to keep ahead. HF1 has a series of articles designed to solve a particular problem in growing middle-class jobs and workforce development. I'm going to highlight a couple of those now, and then I'll ask House Research to walk through the bill more specifically. Article 1 is a solution to our sometimes onerous permitting process for Tier 1 permits. This legislation seeks to move the process from 90 to 45 days and to help move the paperwork more quickly. As you may know, 45 days can be a big help to moving projects forward, especially in our four climate state. Article 2 is a rulemaking reform that will allow the Legislative Coordinating Commission to oversee and flag rules that may be overzealous and egregious. I suspect we can all think of a rule that has been implemented that caused a stir among our constituents and had to be adjusted at the legislative level. This reform will create a legislative step to help prevent rules that may overstep. Article 3 is a tax provision to give 10% exemption to active income from S corporations. Many small businesses and entrepreneurs use an S corp structure as they grow from a startup to a medium business. By the way, these are our jobs that are growing the quickest. If you look at the demographics, it's the companies from 0 to 100 that we rely on the most as we come out of recessions and into growth. However, because these are pass-through entities, entrepreneurs and small businesses are penalized from investing back into the company to hire and invest in the community because all the profits are taxed at the owner's personal income tax. By gaining a 10% exemption, there will be encouragement to grow the company. And as any business owner knows, the worst use of excess capital is to simply retain it. Dollars invested have a much better return than dollars held with a tight fist. But we must signal to our business owners that we are willing to back their risk with tax incentive. New Markets Tax Credit. This provision will encourage insurance companies to use their cash reserves to invest into areas that need mining, manufacturing, Hi-Tech, and Timber. As you may know, idle capital is bad for our economic engine, and capital can either be moved with government tax and distribution or by encouraging companies to invest. It should be no surprise that I support the latter. Research R&D credits. When companies start up, there is a steep ramp up and investment into research and development to get products and ideas to the marketplace. This is the most difficult phase and can be very capital intensive. This provision will give C, S, and LLC structured companies a refundable credit to spur their growth. Article 4, moving on, promotes the development of workforce housing. It sets up a workforce housing lands trust. And I'm going to pause for a second. I can't think of many conversations when I talk about jobs that hasn't involved workforce housing development. So I think this is critical. I think it's a great idea, and it's one of the areas that I'm most excited about in the bill. And to be fair, I'm excited about the entire bill, but this one I'm just more exuberant about. A company that qualifies will invest into a community to acquire land and have that land available for development in single-family units. This will reduce the cost of housing by divorcing the land from the construction cost. The company will gain a refund of 5% annually of their paid out over 20 years as long as they maintain their workforce in the community. Think about this. We're asking companies to make a long-term commitment into these communities, and we're giving them the hooks to stay there and make sure they grow. The community gains workforce housing, an investment for families, and additional workers with the tax base they bring. And as we all know out in many areas of the state, if you hire that tax base, you become less dependent on asking for dollars from the state. Article 5 is an incentive to encourage workers who are trained in the STEM and long-term fields, two areas that are in most need around the state and certainly in our farther reaches of the state in the rural areas. We hear this a lot. We have workers with knowledge and experience. We're asking them to consider to use the quality of life that we find in other areas of the state and to relocate if that works in their best interest. The benefit is a tax credit for 4 years to help recuperate the cost of their education. Finally, Article 6 is an agency filing reform section. This provision will put the agency fines into the general fund and allow the Office of Small Business Advocate to use the 5% of the funds each year to help businesses that unintentionally find themselves out of compliance and need of financial assistance to get compliant. I can tell you as someone who's a serial entrepreneur who has failed as many businesses as I've succeeded in, anytime we can get reform where we can help the businesses, because as an entrepreneur you have these great ideas, you want to start your product up, but you're not as well versed in all the things that we've thrown at them at the bureaucracy level. Things like this can be a big help when you feel like the pressure's intense and suddenly you get that one letter from a state agency saying, oh, you missed up here. This can be a really big big point in bringing that company forward. So, Mr. Chair, if I could, I'd like to turn this over to the House Research and have them walk through the bill specifically.
Thank you very much. We'll look forward to that. Welcome to committee, Ms. Newman.
And if I could, Mr. Chair, an adage I live by is surrounding yourself by really intelligent people. I'm in pretty good shape here.
You got it right. Thank you.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm Anita Newman from House Research. And I will begin with Article 1, which is the environmental permitting efficiency. This article modifies the goals for the Department of Natural Resources and the Pollution Control Agency for making decisions on Tier 1 permits. Goals were established in 2011 and set at 150 days for each of the agencies to issue or deny a permit application. They were modified last session, and the Tier 1 permits were reduced to 90 days. This article would reduce the time for those Tier 1 permits to 45 days. So very quickly, Section 1 of the bill is the Department of Natural Resources permits. Tier 1 permits are defined by the Department of Natural Resources on a case-by-case basis, as I understand it. Section 2 deals with the pollution control agency language to reduce that permit goal to 45 days. And Tier 1 permits are defined in statute within the PCA language as permits that don't require individualized actions or public comment periods. Turning to Article 2, which is the rulemaking reform, this article makes changes to the state rulemaking processes and procedures. Under current law, the House and Senate Governmental Operations Committees or the Legislative Coordinating Commission can object to an existing state rule if the committee or the commission considers the rule to be beyond procedural or substantive authority that the agency has. This authority also extends to proposed rules under current law if an administrative law judge has determined that the agency has not established the need for and reasonableness of the proposed rule. This bill changes that current law in a number of ways. First, it removes the authority for the House and Senate Governmental Operations Committees to object to the rules, leaving intact the Legislative Coordinating Commission authority. It gives the authority to object to rules to all proposed rules. So the requirement that an ALJ make a determination would not apply any longer. And then it extends the grounds for objecting to a rule to a number of other criteria. And those are that the rule is inconsistent with statute, unnecessary or redundant, having substantial economic impact, and that's defined in the next section, not based on sound, reasonable, available information, not cost-effective, unduly burdensome, or more restrictive to federal law, more restrictive than federal law. Section 2 of Article 2 provides the definition of substantial economic impact, which is now one of the criteria for objection on a rule. And that is defined as an adverse impact on Minnesota's private sector economy of $1 million annually, a significant increase in costs or prices, adverse impact on competitiveness of the private sector enterprises are on employment, investment, productivity, or innovation, or compliance cost in the first year after the rule takes effect of more than $25,000 for a business with less than 50 full-time employees or on a city that has less than 10 full-time employees. Section 3 adds language that agencies can only adopt, change, suspend, repeal rules if that authority is expressly delegated to them and only if those changes or the rule is necessary to serve the public interest. Section 4 is explicit language that forbids an agency from seeking to implement or enforce a policy, a guideline, or some other non-binding statement that comes within the definition of rule, and rule is defined in the statute, if the statement or the policy or the guideline has not been adopted as a rule. Section 5 is a new requirement that agencies that are submitting their annual rulemaking docket to the legislature have to submit that to the Legislative Coordinating Commission as well. Section 6 adds to the required contents of the statement of need and reasonableness that agencies have to put out when they seek to adopt or change a rule. The new statement has to include the agency's findings and conclusions that support its determination that the proposed rule does not have a substantial impact. It has to describe with some specificity the scientific, technical, and economic information that supports the proposed rule, and it has to include in its assessment of the cumulative effect of the rules, the effect on all the rules adopted by the agency or any other agency, and all federal guidelines and local ordinances or regulations related to the specific purpose that the rule is being adopted or amended for. Section 7 is a cross-reference to some legislative authority that is being stricken later on in this section, in this article. Section 8 deals with when an agency is adopting a rule using the good cause exemption and requires that the agency give notice to the chairs and ranking minority members of the legislative policy and budget committees that have jurisdiction over the subject matter to which the rule pertains, as well as the Legislative Coordinating Commission. Section 9 requires a slightly different notice and comment when an agency is adopting a rule using the expedited process, and this also requires that the notice be given to the budget and policy chairs and ranking minority members that would have jurisdiction over the subject matter in the rule. And then Section 10 of this article repeals a section of statute that pertains to when legislative approval is required for a proposed rule if the cost of complying with the rule will exceed $25,000 and its effect it has an effect for a business with less than 50 full-time employees or for a city with less than 10 full-time employees.
Welcome to our committee, Mr. Michael.
Mr. Chair, Joel Michael from House Research. I'll go through the provisions of Article 3, 4, and 5, which all contain primarily tax provisions, or in one case, a grant provision. Article 3 has three main tax provisions in it. First, it provides a new markets tax credit for insurance companies in sections 1 through 10. And then it also has a subtraction for pass-through entities on the individual income tax from their taxable income. That's in sections 11 and 15. And finally, there are changes in the research and development credit in sections 12 and 14. The new markets credit, I won't go through this in very specific detail, but in section 2 are the definitions, and it's important to point out a couple of things. Mechanically, the way this credit works is that it will be administered by the Department of Employment and Economic Development, and that qualified community development entities, which essentially are function in this credit structure as a financial intermediary, will apply to DEED for credit authority from a pool that's established by the article. And if they receive that credit authority, a grant of that from DEED, then they in turn can transfer that to an insurance company and receive cash in turn for that, which they're required to invest in a qualified active low-income community business, which is defined in the definition section as a business that's engaged in either high technology as is defined in our angel credit law, or manufacturing, mining, and forestry. The purpose of the federal new markets credit is really to target investment to low-income communities and other areas that need jobs for low-income people. And in order to qualify under this, you have this financial intermediary, the Qualified Community Development Agency entity has to be one that also qualifies under the federal rules. So in effect, this in some ways mirrors the way the federal credit works, although it's really a standalone state credit. And so basically what the community development entity will do is to take that money and make an investment in one of these businesses of the type, and that business will then typically will make a repayment of a low interest loan back to that entity, which then gets paid back potentially to the insurance company. So the insurance company will get an entitlement to the state tax credit, which is 39% over 7 years of what they invested, plus then these interest payments, or I suppose they could be equity payments, but interest payments that are made by the recipient business. Section 3 establishes the entitlement to the credit. The percentage actually is in Section 1's definition, but if you look at the summary for Section 3, you can see the various credit rates. So the first 2 years when the insurance company has this credit, they don't actually get a tax benefit from it. The tax benefit only starts in the second year after they've made the investment, and then it's at the rates that are shown in the summary, 8% for the first 4 of those years, and then 7%. The federal credit has similarly a 7% period, but a different percentage structure. Section 4 prohibits the recipient insurance company from transferring or selling the credit to another entity. The initial recipient of the credit could be a parent of the insurance company, and so those transfers are permitted, but the insurance company is not permitted to sell the credit on the open market. Section 5 sets out the rules for what are qualifying equity investments that can receive the credit, and the things that the community development entity has to go through in order to get that certification from DEED. They have to provide evidence that they've been certified by the Treasury Department under the federal credit. They have to show a copy of the allocation agreement that they've had with the business and so forth. And they also have to make an application fee and a sort of a security deposit to guarantee to DEED that they're actually going to qualify and perform as required by the credit. This section sets the cap on the amount of investments that DEED can allocate to the credit, which is at $250 million. That, because of the 39% credit rate, if you do the math, that'll allow up to $97.5 million in tax credits being paid. Because of the effective date that's in the article, none of the cost of this credit will actually occur in the current biennium or the next biennium. In part, that's because applications are not allowed until 2017, and then if you remember from that credit structure, the first 2 years after the insurance company makes the investment, they don't get a credit. So when you ultimately see a revenue estimate for this bill, it will show up as zeros on all of those for this credit, because it's essentially going to be incurred outside the budget window. Section 6 sets up rules for the cases in which the credit is disallowed. That's like a clawback provision that says if you don't comply with certain things, you'll have to repay the credit back to the state for this community development agency. Some of those are if you redeem the credit so that you're actually getting the money back instead of the business using it to invest and create something, then you have to repay the credit. Section 7 is the way that's implemented by providing a notice of noncompliance. Section 8 sets out the terms for the performance fee that I mentioned. The terms of that are set up in the definition section of the article, and it's basically 0.5% of the amount up to $500,000. And again, if the entity fails to follow through with what the credit requires, so for example, they didn't issue the full amount of the qualified equity investments, which go to the actual businesses that are going to do the activity, then they would forfeit this fee in addition to the credit being clawed back from them. And secondly, if they make less than the full amount, then this fee is forfeited proportionately into the amount. So if they only invested half of it, then half of this performance fee would be clawed back. Section 9 provides a procedure for the community development entity to go to DEED and get certain investments pre-qualified so it knows that it will meet the requirements. Section 10 sets out prohibited uses of the proceeds. And this is largely intended to prevent sort of recycling of the money and avoiding the purpose for which the credit was established. Section 11 and Section 15 are the exemption, are the subtraction for 10% of income that's realized by pass-through entities. That's S-corps, partnerships, and of course under the tax law, multi-member limited liability companies are also taxed generally as partnerships unless they elect to be taxed as corporations, and so they would also qualify for this. In order to qualify for the subtraction, the taxpayer would have to materially participate in the business. So if you're a passive investor in an S-corp or an LLC, you would not get this subtraction. It's only the people who are actively involved in carrying out the business. Section, and that's that change is effective for tax year 15, so that will go into effect for the current tax year if it's enacted. Section 12 increases the second tier of the research and development credit from a rate of 2.5% to 4%. This rate applies to qualifying investments in excess of $2 million. The credit rate on the first $2 million is 10%. That's not changed by the bill, but Section 14 makes that portion of the credit that's attributable to that first tier refundable, which means that if the corporation or the partnership or the S-corp does not have enough tax liability to use up that research credit, they will receive a refund from the state for the amount of the credit. That's the way the credit was for the entire credit for the period between 2010 and 2012. The 2013 legislature repealed that feature of the credit, so this reinstates it, but only for the first tier. And that's basically a summary of the tax provisions of Article 3. Article 4...
And with that, Representative Mahoney has a question, I believe.
Okay.
We're trying to give time for testimony, but yet questions to him.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And your remarks to, I think it is, well, two questions, but I think I can get, I'll just go with the one. You mentioned the angel investment tax credit. We significantly expanded the businesses that are allowable in that, I think it was last year. Does this credit, this new market credit, cover all those expanded areas that we went into?
Mr. Michaels.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mahoney, I think probably the best way to say this is that it covers businesses in the, at least as many businesses, at least the same fields of business as are covered by the angel credit. It does not have some of the restrictions that are in it, that are in the angel credit. For example, the business is not required to have an innovative or variety of those, you know, sort of high techy words that are in the angel credit. That's not part of this. It's just that they have to be operating in one of these fields that are listed there, either a high technology field or manufacturing, mining, and forestry. In order to qualify for this credit. So I'm not sure. I would have to actually go back and carefully compare the new angel credit language with this to make sure. But in general, I think some kind of tourism businesses, if they have something that's innovative, qualify for the angel credit. Tourism is not listed here. Agriculture is not listed here, so you would qualify under the angel credit if you're doing something that's considered to be innovative in agriculture. Now, most like agricultural processing would be covered by this because it's a type of manufacturing, and so it would fit within that. But in general, this credit does not require that innovative overlay that's part of the angel credit.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Would you please continue, Mr. Michaels?
Article 4 has two basic provisions. It creates a workforce housing grant program, and then it also establishes a tax credit for contributions to a land trust to provide land for workforce housing. The Section 1 establishes the Workforce Housing Grant Program. This would be administered by deed, and it would make grants to cities. In order to qualify, cities would have to have a population of 1,500 or more. They'd have to have a housing rental housing vacancy rate of 5% or less for the preceding 2 years, and that would also have to be true of any other city that's located within 25 miles of the applicant city. They'd also have to have one or more employers in the city that have made a request in writing that the lack of available workforce housing, rental housing, has been a sort of impediment to them hiring employees. The fourth requirement is there cannot be more than five or more residential units that were constructed per 1,000 population in each of the last 10 years before the application was made. And finally, they'd have to pledge to use the money to make grants to help build workforce housing, and that could be done in a variety of ways. They could make loans to developers, they could pay for infrastructure, or they could provide land, or a variety of different ways that they could assist the workforce housing. Sections 2 and 3 just make sure that for the tax credit that's in Section 4, that if those contributions are deducted by the taxpayer in computing their federal tax and state tax, that they have to be added back for Minnesota tax purposes, so the business does not get both a deduction and a credit. Section 4 is what sets out the credit for contributions to a local land trust. To qualify, it has to be a qualified city that has basically the same characteristics that I went through before for the grant program, except that there's no requirement that an employer make the request. I think the assumption is that if they're willing to contribute money to the land trust, that then there's no reason, that's evidence enough that they feel that there's a need for workforce housing in that area. The credit actually is equal to 100% of the amount of the contribution, but the business doesn't get that immediately. It gets it only over a 20-year period. They get 5% a year over 20 years. So even though they're getting all their money back, when you take into account the present value of money, there is a net cost to the credit. Section 5 directs the Housing Finance Agency to develop a plan to encourage the creation of land trusts for workforce housing. And then Section 6 has a $5 million appropriation for fiscal 16 for those workforce housing grants, and that's a one-time appropriation, so it would not get put into the base budget. Article 5 creates a new credit for STEM and long-term care employees. This is a refundable credit for individuals who have either a 2 or a 4-year degree in one of the listed science, technology, engineering, math, or medicine, and they have gone to work in a qualified economic development region, which is defined as a economic development region that has a high percentage of job vacancies in one of those fields, as measured by the deed job vacancy data. This credit would be 50% of the state grant allowance under the higher education grant program, and it would be a 5-year credit again, so that they would get it. And it's got a $5,000 maximum for someone who has a 4-year degree, and a $2,500 maximum for someone with a 2-year degree. And it's a 5-year credit, so they would be allowed to claim it, you know, in year 1, year 2, 3, and so forth through 5. And that essentially is a description of that credit and the tax provisions in the bill.
Mr. Chair and members, I'm going to turn you now to Article 6, which is the state agency penalty reform article. And I'm only going to talk about Sections 1 and Section 8, Section 18, because those are the two really significant sections in this article. Section 1 requires that any civil or administrative fine or penalty that's collected by a state agency would now have to be deposited in the general fund with sort of two major categories of exceptions. An exception would be funds that the Constitution requires be deposited somewhere other than the general fund. And the second is if the revenue from the penalty is deposited by law in a fund other than the general fund and that money is not already statutorily appropriated back to an agency. Sections 2 through 17, which follow here, are simply conforming sections. It's a list of a variety of funds that language would have to be modified in order to make this change effective. The other significant section is on page 46 of your bill. It's section 18, and that is where a new business assistance compliance grant program is established. And this would direct the Commissioner of Deed to make grants to businesses with 15 or fewer employees to assist the businesses in complying with state laws. The grants would be available to businesses that have unknowingly violated a state law and subsequently paid a penalty to the state, or that were required to make a substantial investment in equipment in order to comply with the law. And this section would take 5% of that penalty and fine revenue, which goes to the general fund now, and appropriate it to this new grant program. Then the remainder of the sections 19 through 30 again are conforming changes to the redirection of penalty and fine revenue. And that concludes the bill.
Appreciate it very much. With that, we will go. Well, I think right now we should have the testifiers be limited to 3 minutes so we can have time to get our committee work done. And I think we'll start the testifiers. Start out with testifiers in opposition to the bill. We would like to have people come testify if you have opposition to the bill. Please come forward, and you're limited to 3 minutes, just like the people are testifying for the bill. So with that, anybody, again, would like to testify in opposition to the bill? Seeing none, we'll start out with Beth Cadoon from the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce to come down and testify for the bill. And when we're done with this testimony, we will have questions from the membership.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Beth Cadoon. I represent the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, an organization of 2,300 businesses across the state of Minnesota. I'm here to testify, and I'll keep my testimony short as requested, on the pass-through entity provision that we support, as well as the R&D credit. I'll just touch base more on the pass-through entity. We consistently hear from our membership across the state of Minnesota on their really desire to, you know, grow their business in Minnesota. However, we also hear from them that they're one of their top issues and kind of their top burdens to be able to do that is our high taxes in the state of Minnesota. And what this does, and one of the reasons we consistently rank high on our tax burdens across the state or across the nation is due to the high individual income tax. Minnesota, as you heard, for our business community, is that over 90% of our businesses in the state are pass-through entities. That means they pay their income tax, they pay their business tax, excuse me, through the individual income tax. So those are your sole proprietors, your LLCs, your subchapter S, as well as your partnerships. And so with our rate of 9.85, we have the fourth highest individual income tax in the nation, which also means we have the fourth highest tax on our pass-through businesses in the nation as well. This is a really growing part of our business climate, and this is true nationwide as well as Minnesota, is on our pass-through entities. Over 55% of the private sector in the state is is projected is also employed by pass-through entities. And so we want to make sure that those pass-through entities have a competitive business tax environment. And this bill we support because it does provide an exemption of part of that business income, and we think that would be a benefit to be able to grow those companies in the state. This is also taxed, as you'll hear from pass-through companies, it's called a phantom income, which is they're taxed on this income even though they're never really received it. It's used to reinvest back in their companies, back in capital equipment, back in their employees. And so when you reduce the tax burn on that, it really does encourage those businesses to be able to expand in the state. The other provision I want to mention is to testify in favor of that R&D credit expansion. One of Minnesota's strengths has been our ability to innovate. This has been true throughout kind of our state's history, and why I think we kind of lead the nation a lot of times in economic growth, and why we've been able to have, been really blessed to have all our Fortune 500 companies as well, is because of our ability to innovate. And it really started with some entrepreneur with an idea on either a product or service and really grow those businesses in the state. What all our Fortune 500 companies have in common is they're homegrown. So the question when you move forward is how do you continue to have that strong innovation in the state? And we think one of the key strategic tax provisions we've had in the state is our R&D credit. We were the first state to enact that in 1982. Since then, many states have enacted an R&D credit and surpassed Minnesota. And I'll know you hear from some other testifiers regarding how we compete with other states, but we're strongly in favor of that expansion as well. The other provision I'll just mention is the affordable housing piece. We're continuing to hear from more and more of our membership in greater Minnesota how housing is becoming a bigger issue for their ability to grow jobs in the state. And so I certainly appreciate Representative Kreisha including that provision as well. With that, I do have one of our member companies here, Molly Youngbauer, and she's a pass-through business, so if you would be important to hear from her as well.
Very well. Ms. Youngbauer, would you please come forward and give us your testimony? She's a CEO of the Halsted Company. Welcome.
That's right. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I am, again, the CEO and co-owner of Halsted & Associates. We are an IT consulting firm here in the Twin Cities, and we employ over 200 people in the state of Minnesota. I'm also a CPA with more than 12 years of tax preparation experience, so have extensive tax knowledge as well. I'm here today to share my personal story as the owner of a successful small business that has been negatively impacted by the additional fourth tier 2% in individual income tax bracket, which I really truly believe our state leaders did not intend or understand the negative consequences this additional tier would have on Minnesota businesses when they passed this law. My business, like many small businesses, is structured as a pass-through entity. My husband and I bought our company in 2012 for more millions than I've ever seen in my lifetime. We both come from middle-class families, so we didn't have the personal funds to purchase the company. Therefore, we had to take out loans and personally guarantee them for more millions than all of our personal assets combined. We took a huge risk and have risked everything that we worked very hard for over our 25-year career. In 2013, we were blindsided when our income taxes were increased by 6% in total, 4% at the federal level and 2% at the state. And in Minnesota, this increase was passed retroactively in May, which didn't even allow us the time to budget for this. The IT consulting industry is a very low-margin, portable industry. Our clients are large Fortune 100 clients or bigger, and they put a lot of pressure on us to keep our prices under control. We are very, very, for the most part, a very large portion of their annual budgets. This means if the cost of our services continue to climb, then our clients will use non-Minnesota consulting firms because many of our services can be provided remotely. The IT consulting industry in Minnesota currently employs over 40,000 people in the state, so this would have a significant impact on Minnesota jobs, and these are very well-paying jobs, by the way. As state leaders, I would like to remind you that today's economy is global and taxes are local. The tax rates Minnesota businesses are subject to directly impact our ability to compete with other non-Minnesota businesses. And with every dollar of tax added to our costs, we have to find a way to save a dollar elsewhere. The reality is the savings will most likely come from labor costs, which will ultimately impact Minnesota's unemployment rate. As state leaders, please remember that small businesses are not inconsequential to the Minnesota economy. According to the SBA, 98% of Minnesota employers are small businesses. In addition, we employ 52% of the private sector workforce in Minnesota. And we were also responsible for 63% of net new job growth created between 1993 and 2013. Therefore, if government continues to impede small business growth, they are in fact impeding Minnesota's economic growth. Personally, my company's hiring pace has slowed due to the cost burden of the tax increase. We had to delay hiring several employees because of this burden and instead find ways to make do without the additional resources. My company offers jobs that are professional and well-paying, many in the six figures. These jobs would not only help Minnesota's unemployment rate, but also help its underemployment rate, which is another issue that, in my opinion, is not being addressed enough by our state leaders. I hear a lot of rhetoric about the diminishing middle class in Minnesota, and we should be rightfully concerned about this issue. Increasing taxes for small businesses has added another obstacle to resolving this issue. If the majority of job growth has historically come from small businesses, then we need to do whatever we can to help them grow so they can continue to provide well-paying jobs to our citizens. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And next on the line we have Mike Hickey. Welcome to our committee.
Well, thanks, Mr. Chairman. And members, Mike Hickey with the National Federation of Independent Business. And for those of you who don't know a lot about NFIB, we're the state's largest small business group with 13,000 members and nationwide over 300,000. I just wanted to talk briefly to a few of the provisions of this large bill. We strongly support the 10% exemption on the income tax. Yeah, I don't want to be overly redundant to Beth Cadoon's and Molly Jungbauer's comments, but there's been a huge trend for companies to flow through sub S LLC and pay their taxes on the individual income tax. It's been a large trend. Some very large companies have even gotten to it, but it's the vast majority, over 90% of our businesses now. So this 10% exemption is certainly going to help these companies and be a positive shot in the arm for them. And we really appreciate that. It's also, in some way, going to some degree, mitigate some of the damage we did with enacting the very high 9.85 rate that's hit our most successful entrepreneurs in this state. So we're helping diffuse that to some degree, but that has really been a lot, about a 25% tax increase, I believe, for those companies. And these are very successful entrepreneurs who employ a lot of people. And so that was a negative direction we went in 2013. Then it certainly helps. And we really appreciate it. Just very few companies I think you'll find these days are C-Corps. They're probably very large. And so, as Representative Kresh has said, the vast majority of businesses in your community are these flow-through companies, and they'll benefit from that provision. We sure appreciate what we're trying to do on permits, third year in a row on this, but obviously there's more room for improvement. 45 days would be just very desirable if decisions could be turned around that quick. It is just tier one, though, as you know, very large development projects that have a lot of jobs are probably not going to be covered by this. Those types of projects are going to trigger public hearing and public comment, but appreciate the progress we're trying to make there. I haven't totally sorted out everything on the rulemaking reforms, and I know others in the House are also looking at a lot of things, but anything to give people a greater say and more accountability is appreciated, so we certainly appreciate a lot of the provisions. I did notice the Governmental Operations Committee is taken out of the loop, though, for being able to strike a regulation, and you might want to reconsider that. In our view, the more parties in this House and this legislature that have a say in trying to raise an objection to a rule, the better, and we'll be in touch with the author on the various rulemaking proposals, and I know the Governmental Operations Committee is really looking at doing some significant things this year, and thanks for the time.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Patrick Hines, League of Minnesota Cities, welcome to our committee, Patrick.
Thank Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Patrick Hines. I'm with the League of Minnesota Cities, and I'm here to testify in support of the workforce housing provisions of House File 1, which are in Article 4. Since we only have a few minutes, I wanted to try to answer a few very basic questions about what workforce housing is and why it's important. The term is used a lot, and oftentimes the definitions can vary between people who use them. From the League's perspective, as we work with our cities in greater Minnesota, we feel that workforce housing is market-rate housing that is necessary to accommodate job growth in communities that have a demonstrated lack of housing stock. The characteristics of these communities would be communities with very low vacancy rates, and with very low unemployment rates, and with low rental rates that hamper the financing of new market housing. And these communities also have existing employers who are ready and willing to expand their operations but can't because of the lack of housing. Many of the communities some of the communities that are dealing with this issue include Roseau and Thief River Falls, Perham, Worthington, Jackson, Gaylord, Laverne, as a few examples. And one of the most basic questions we get when we talk about workforce housing, and was one of the first questions I asked my member cities when they brought this issue forward, is if there is such a demand for workforce housing in your communities, why haven't private developers built the housing to meet that demand? And while it's complicated, I think we've come up with a short answer for now, at least. And the cost of building market-rate housing in many greater Minnesota communities far exceeds the amount of money that's available to finance the construction. And unlike affordable housing, there are no state or federal grants or incentives to help finance new market-rate housing, and there are very limited options for local governments to finance it. And that's really where the problem is, because you simply can't finance these projects even if you have a willing developer. One of the good things about the proposed program in House File 1 is that we have a pilot program in place right now that the legislature passed last session. And the city of Roseau is the first city to receive grant money to help develop workforce housing, and that project is under construction now. So we already have an idea about some of the financing problems, and I'll very quickly give you an example of what Roseau is facing. The project that's under construction is 30 units of market-rate rental housing. The construction cost is approximately $3.2 million. And when the appraisal was done on the project, the appraised value came back at $2.15 million. As you can see, you've got a development project that is immediately underwater before you've even put a shovel in the ground. And that's not the type of project that a developer is typically going to undertake. The reason the appraised value is so low is because the rental rates in Roseau and in many communities are depressed. The average rental rate in Roseau for a one-unit house is somewhere around $500 to $600 a month. If you run the numbers on this particular project, the developer would have to charge rental rates of $1,000 to $1,200 a month in order to finance it. So you can see there's a really big gap between what the market rate is and what is needed to finance a project. And the other issue, and I'm sorry for getting a little deep in the weeds, a bank simply can't lend more than 80% of the appraised value of a project. So when the appraised value is far below the actual construction cost, you have another enormous financing gap to overcome. And so that's why we think the program that is in House File 1 is important, to try to help cities develop this market rate housing and get people into good paying jobs in those communities. And thank you for your time.
Thank you very much for your testimony. We are running close to time, so please try to honor our 3-minute period of time for testimony. Dan Dorman, next on the dock. Look forward to your testimony, Minnesota Business Partnership. Minnesota, Greater Minnesota Partnership, excuse me.
Mr. Chair, happy to be before you. I don't know if I've ever said anything in 3 minutes or less, so I'll struggle to do that, but I'll get it done.
I have a lot of confidence.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members, we want to testify in support of the workforce housing provision. We're going to come before the committee next week with an idea that we think will supplement that, that will add to that, because we think there needs to be several tools put together. So we talk more about that next week. I did provide a handout of our proposal for the committee to look at, but in order to stay within 3 minutes, and since we're going to testify next week, Mr. Chair, we'll limit, or I won't comment any more on workforce housing and move to the regulatory reform piece. And we are very supportive of the many provisions of the regulatory rulemaking found in House File Number 1, but we believe that they're insufficient to address the overreaching actions by the MPCA, particularly in the area of water quality. In our opinion, the reform should include a couple of key provisions: that major rules be subject to independent scientific-based peer review, similar to the review required by the US EPA in their rulemaking process. Additionally, a cost-benefit analysis of major new rules should be reviewed and approved by the entire legislature before being implemented. Our concern about review only by the Legislative Coordinating Commission, first of all, we don't think it's sufficient enough, and from a greater Minnesota standpoint, if you look up at the makeup of the committee, and they're all good people, but of the 10 people, only three of them are from greater Minnesota, so that makes us a little nervous on the surface of that. We think that it's incumbent of the entire legislature to weigh in on these provisions. We think that a real-world study should be undertaken, particularly on some of these major water initiatives, to see what the actual cost will be to consumers throughout the state, not just in greater Minnesota, but to look at the cumulative effect of proposed rules and see what this will do, not just on the industrial side, but also for the average consumer in these communities. And the fourth concern that we'd like to see addressed is the seemingly growing or increasing reinterpretation of existing rules and the development of strategies or guidance, and we think this should be subject to the full rulemaking process and should not simply go around that and say, gee, we're simply reinterpreting based on new science. We think that what that does is it really, from a due process standpoint, locks not just the legislature, but citizens out of participating in that process in how these rules are developed. So our organization believes that it's time for the legislature to be very proactive in trying to rein some of these overreaching things in. You know, we've worked with other groups that want to be more defensive in nature and kind of fight things, bad ideas, as they say, as they come up. We think it's more important to be proactive and try to really set good policy for the future. So with that, Mr. Chair, that's our comments on that provision.
Barely made it.
Thank you.
Now, next, we have Tony Quillis. Welcome to our committee. And Tony represents the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Tony Quillis. I'm the Director of Environmental Policy at the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, and I will get you back on track, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for your time today to comment on House File 1, and thank you to Representative Kreshaw for authoring it. My concerns are, just to echo what former Representative Dorman said on the regulatory reform, and also, you know, from our members in a number of venues, whether it's been through regional meetings, through surveys of the business community in general, or through our members, and through Grow Minnesota, which is an affiliate of the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, where we visit with businesses throughout the state, thank them for doing business here in the state of Minnesota, and ask them what we can do to help them expand or make their life easier, if you will, in the state of Minnesota. And one of the things that comes up is the time, the cost, and the uncertainty and the environmental permitting and environmental review process in the state of Minnesota. It's important because future capital investment is affected, as well as economic opportunities and jobs. When people look at things to locate or expand here in the state of Minnesota, some of the things they look at, you've heard here today, whether it be taxes, workforce, housing, energy costs. But one of the other things they look at is how long it's going to take, the time and the cost to do our environmental permitting here in the state of Minnesota. You know, and you heard Ms. Jungbauer talk about how it's a global economy right now. It's not just state by state or regional. It is international and global. So we want to remain competitive there while also protecting the natural resources of the state. But we look forward to working with you and the legislature as well as the Dayton administration. As Mr. Hickey said, it's been since 2011 that we've been working on trying to get us to be the gold standard that other states look to. And we keep looking for further streamlining and efficiencies, other options and pilot projects. I saw Ms. Howe here from the Department of Employment and Economic Development. One of the successes I think we've had is called Minnesota Business First Stop. I think Representative Mahoney was helpful when we moved that through back last year, a couple years ago, was instrumental in helping do that with Commissioner Phillips, who's now IRRB commissioner. But we want to, again, try and get the standards set so that all other states look to us, and as Governor Dayton said, to get his regulatory agencies to operate at the speed of commerce. Mr. Chairman, with that, I'd stand for any questions.
We'll have questions later. Thank you very much for your testimony. Toby Pearson, Care Providers of Minnesota. Carrie Thurlow is going to come with him. But I like efficiency. Please give us your testimony.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Carrie Thurlow. I'm the Senior Vice President of Leading Age Minnesota, and here on behalf of the Long-Term Care Imperative. And Mr. Chair, if we are nothing, we are efficient today with our testimony. With me is also Toby Pearson with Care Providers as well. We just want to be very brief and speak to the provisions in Article 5 related to long-term care employment incentives. If some of you, I know some of you sit on the Aging and Long-Term Care Committee and probably heard from a number of providers yesterday about our workforce challenges here in Minnesota with regard to the shortage of professional caregivers to take care of our seniors. The Long-Term Care Imperative estimates that just in nursing homes alone, which is just a fraction of the care that we provide for seniors, we have over 1,800 vacant positions in nursing homes today. That's not to account for the growing demand for caregivers that we have as we prepare for a growing senior population. Each year, we will have 60,000 Minnesotans turn 65. That's about 165 new seniors each day. And so we are very glad that there are provisions such as those in Article 5 to help build the pipeline and to encourage more people to come to the growing field of long-term care services and supports to help us meet the needs for seniors, and look forward to working with this committee and many of you here to address the growing needs for caring for our senior population. With that, I'm going to turn it over to Mr. Pearson.
Welcome to the committee. Mr. Pearson, give your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Toby Pearson with Care Providers in Minnesota. Also today, on behalf of Long-Term Care Imperative, as Carrie outlined, there are a lot of challenges facing recruitment and retention of employees in our long-term care settings. The long-term care employment incentive in Article 5 is just another tool that we'd like to use to try to recruit and retain more employees. We look forward to working with the author on this proposal to make sure that it works well for all of our long-term care settings. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Next, we have Genevieve Plumador. Is that correct? Wonderful. Welcome to our committee. Give your name for the record, please.
Hi, thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Genevieve Plumador with Life Science Alley. I'm here representing nearly 700 members in Minnesota that represent the medical devices and the high technology companies in our state. Just want to thank you for the opportunity to comment on the provisions in House File 1 having to do with the research and development tax credit. Minnesota's economy has long benefited from research-based corporations, and the R&D tax credit that we've had since 1981 has really leveraged a lot of investment into these industries, as evidenced by the technology hub that we have here and such an impressive footprint of medical technology. Our industry directly employs 48,000 Minnesotans, and the provider network that has grown out of that hub employs an additional 120,000 indirect jobs. So quite the footprint, like I said. The refundability provisions would make our credit, our R&D tax credit, once again more robust and more competitive. I provided for the group a handout comparing some of the other states in the country that are vying to be the next medical technology hub and have been luring some of our companies to leave Minnesota. And if you compare and contrast, our credit, once the refundability was taken away 2 years ago, has really brought us lower in the scale of competitiveness. And you have other states such as Colorado and New York looking to Minnesota to emulate the refundability program that we did have once, and they're looking to instate that in their states as well. Of the 678 companies in the life sciences, 79% have less than 50 employees. So again, the refundability aspect of the credit would help those small startups that are going through the arduous FDA process that could take anywhere from 5, 8 to 10 years before that company does become profitable. They have to go through that process in order to have a product to market. Additionally, raising the second tier of the formula does send a message to the rest of the country that Minnesota understands the importance of the medical technology hub here in Minnesota, and that credit could mean additional jobs, investments in research, and further collaboration with our renowned research institutions. And these investments could potentially lead to the next best invention, the next best life-saving therapy coming from Minnesota. And just to leave with the committee also, our average salary for our employees in the life sciences is $95,600. So these are high-paying jobs that we could retain here in Minnesota and attract further jobs here in Minnesota. So I did attempt to get a Greater Minnesota company to come and visit with you today. Unfortunately, they could not make the trek to the Capitol, but I would be remiss not to mention some of our great members in technology hubs, such as in Rochester that have grown around Mayo, Worthington, Wilmer, and the St. Cloud area. So we do have some Greater Minnesota members that would benefit from this as well. Unfortunately, couldn't get one to make the trek down. So with that, I will end the testimony. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Please give your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is John Dukic. I manage public policy and entrepreneurship for the Minnesota High Tech Association, and thank you for the opportunity to testify today. MHTA represents more than 300 science and technology companies across the state with the goal of helping Minnesota become one of the nation's top five technology states. And I'm here today to testify in support of the R&D provisions of House File 1. The Research and Development Tax Credit plays an important role in Minnesota's innovation economy, particularly as we compete with other states and nations to attract innovative, high-tech businesses to Minnesota. And to put this in perspective, consider Massachusetts and California, which routinely rank among the top states in terms of innovation and technology. Massachusetts, for example, has a 10% R&D tax credit on any qualified research expense, and 15% for basic research expenses. California is even stronger, with a 15% credit on qualified research expenses and 24% on basic research expenses. So strengthening Minnesota's R&D tax credit will help us better compete with these and other states. And I won't reiterate what Genevieve said, but we are supportive of an increase in the second tier of the R&D credit from 2.5% to 4%, and are certainly supportive of making the R&D credit refundable. And with that, thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony, John. With that, we'll open up testimony for other testifiers in the public. So anybody would like to testify from the audience, now is your time. We really look forward to your pearls of wisdom. Oh, it's more noisy than that at my dinner table. Well, okay, then we'll go to the members. We would look and covet your questions about this bill. We have heard a lot of very good testimony, and we have Representative Norton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have just a number of questions throughout the articles, but first I just wanted if you could help us with process. So Mr. Chair, could I ask just a couple questions about process here?
Certainly.
Okay. So we're having a bill, but we're not voting on it today.
That's great. We're laying it over.
And is this a bill that's then going to be broken up and go through different committees and then come back to us and then we will take it up again?
I believe there's a strong possibility of that happening. My crystal ball is not completely clear, but I know it's going to go to other committees. It has to, because of the jurisdictional part of it. And we will probably have a chance to look at the whole completed bill, either on the floor or here.
Okay.
I would prefer it here.
Yeah, I would. I hope it will be here, Mr. Chair. And so my second kind of procedural question is, I do have just a number of questions personally, and I'm sure other people will here too, because our job is to give feedback, but not that kind of feedback. To give feedback and help with our own comfort level on the bill, but also perhaps make the bill better. That's our job here at the Capitol. So would you like us to go article by article? I don't want to spend a lot. I've got a lot of questions myself. I don't want to hog the mic. So could we just go article by article?
If you would prefer to go article by article, bear in mind that we have to be on the House floor. However, I don't want to hold any debate and discussion back, so we certainly can get this room for later if necessary.
Okay. Well, I'll start with just a quick question on Article 1, and then if other folks want to do whatever they want to do, they can, and if not, I'll ask the rest of my questions. So my Article 1 question had to do with the environmental permitting efficiency. Since I've been at the Capitol, I think this has been before us almost every year, if not every year, and we keep lowering it. And I vaguely recall some discussion on the House floor trying to lower it from the 90 that I think was passed to 75, and I think we were told that that wasn't doable by the departments. So I guess my question is, have you talked with the department, Representative Crecia, and they've assured you that they can do 45, or is this just kind of a, if they couldn't do 75 last year, I'm worried about imposing 45. So I'm just wondering if you've asked them and what their feedback was.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the question. I have had one conversation with the Assistant Commissioner for MPCA, and we've had that conversation. I don't necessarily think it's our job to ask them what they can do as much as we try to push to hear from what we hear from our constituents, but we're having a back and forth on that. Certainly we don't want to push them into an unreasonable spot, but what I've heard on this tier one level, that these are merely there's no public hearing. They're merely formalities. Most of them are paperwork. And I don't think there should be as much pushback on that. And that's what they've said. But I don't have agreement. They're not here testifying against me. They're not here testifying for this bill. But, yes, I'm sure that with the nature of business and investment, we're going to continue to hear this.
Okay. Representative Mahoney.
Is that all, Mr. Chair? From Representative Norton. That was nice.
Oh, I have a bunch of questions, but I'll just wait my turn and ask them as we move through the bill.
Well, I've got a few here, and I'll just do two because hopefully this bill will come back. I'll start with this continued watering down of regulations and review. Maybe you can exempt the urban area, please. Please. I've been on this committee for 16 years, and I have been fighting tooth and nail to get brownfield cleanup money. Now, some of you may know what this is. I know the chair does. And we've cleaned up probably 100, 150 acres in my district, just in my district. And I still have 200 acres to clean up. This is from past, not that long ago, companies that have either gone bankrupt or whatever. So I've got 200 acres yet to clean up in my small legislative district at anywhere from $25,000 an acre to clean up to $1.3 million per acre to clean up. So if you in Greater Minnesota want to loosen those regulations, I think that's a great idea. Go right ahead and do it. But don't impose that on urban Minnesota. Because frankly, that $25,000 or $1.3 million is taxpayer dollars. And I've always tried to be a good steward of taxpayer dollars in this committee. And you are going down a road, the more you loosen these regulations, the more problems you'll have. But on Greater Minnesota, that's just fine.
Dr. Vasil Mahoney, on brownfields, for example, I did ask for a bill from deed to be drafted, and I do anticipate you signing on to that bill.
Yeah.
And it's something that, in my opinion and yours, doesn't cost money. It gives us money. There is no boundary from Greater Minnesota to Metro at all in that whole topic. In Metro, it has a bigger purpose, perhaps, than it does in Greater Minnesota, in that in order to have money properly remediated for light manufacturing, etc., we have to get the blighted areas cleaned up. And I totally understand that, and I think it's the author's intention of not limiting anyone any part of this money.
Well, Mr. Chair, I think if you were hearing me, I did not say that, you know, if you want to lower those particular standards, that's just fine, but I'd like an opt-out because I'm tired of fighting this particular battle.
There you are.
Because we only put in $2 or $3 million, maybe $4 million a year, a biennium, into brownfield cleanup and then require property taxpayers to pick up the rest. That's very difficult and it's a hard number to get to. The other piece on the R&D credit, I'm not opposed to a R&D credit, but you might want to take a look at under the size of the company that you put this to. If you go to the websites of these large research facilities, research companies that deal in research, typically their tax bill is very, very small. It is not 9%, it is not 7%, it is not 3%. The big numbers are, as they were earlier stated, is pass-through and partnerships for the companies with less than 50 or 60 employees. Now, everyone brings up Massachusetts and California. Massachusetts has a very high, a very well-funded, huge endowment private university. In California, I think, has at least two, if not three, with both those. So, you know, the governor just the other day said maybe we should go from a number 16 medical school, into the 20s in a medical school at the U, back up to a top 10 when we had a significant number of researchers coming out of the top 10, a top 10 university. Whatever we give to the R&D credit, you might be taking away from a top 10 university medical school, which at the end of the day helps us all, not just business, but I'd like to surpass my father's age limit, and you know, I think they might help. Just a couple of words of wisdom, and there's an awful lot on this bill that I have questions on. I don't want to take up the whole committee time, so I'll be looking forward to when it comes back.
Any other questions from the members? Representative Norton.
Okay. Article 5, you're talking to somebody whose career before this was working in the STEM field, so it's an area I'm very, very interested in. But as I'm reading this, the credit equals 50% of the state grant allowance. So does that mean money currently being used for state grants will now be used for this? And I want to make sure I'm understanding that correctly.
Representative Precia.
And thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Norton. I think if I could, I'd like to bring the House researcher up. I understand it, but that question particularly, I want to make sure I get correct. So,
welcome back to our committee, sir.
Mr. Chairman, Joel Michael from House Research. Representative Norton, the state grant program is simply used as a benchmark to determine the amount of the credit entitlement. It doesn't have any effect on eligibility for grants or the funding that's available for the grants. That will be determined by how much the legislature appropriates for that program. Somewhere I have written down here what I think the current limits are for those. I believe that they're tied to, I'm not sure about the exact number because Ms. Manzi gave me a different number than what I had taken off of their website, but it's for a two-year program, it's slightly less than 7,004. Private four-year, it's slightly less than 11,000. So those 50% rates would be applied to that to determine what the maximum is, right?
And if I could, I would just add to that, and part of that in statute, and our part of this is we're looking at the Minsky rate. So we would look at the year of graduation and what the Minsky tuition would have been at that point to help set that rate, if that helps.
Thank you.
I think so, Mr. Chair. And I'm going to dig into this a little bit further. I think my question, and I'm sure you can't answer it, would be as when we're from scratch, how many of those students that are getting state grants and graduating now, what percent of them are STEM education? Because there are lots of STEM careers that we need to have folks fill the jobs, STEM is a very large and broad definition, and it could be a very large and broad number of people that we're talking about giving credits to. So I just was trying to get a feel for how much money we're talking about here, because I don't know how many graduates actually we could call STEM graduates. I suspect it's a pretty large number, so I was just trying to get my head around that. So I'll dig into that further. On Article 6, you're talking about the penalties, and I guess my question then for you, Representative Kreisch, is money that's currently being penalized and comes back to the departments, what is that money being used for today in each of these departments? Is it part of their budget, or, you know?
Representative Kreisch.
And thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Norton. As I understand that now, that is used in their budgets. It goes back, and the intent of this is to make sure that as agencies set their budget, they're working within those budgets, and they're not using this as a revenue stream to fill a shortfall gap. So the encouragement is, if you're going to go out and you're going to fine, you do that under your jurisdiction and your charter, and not necessarily look at it as a way of, hey, if we increase our oversight or are a little bit more aggressive in finding, we can pick up some revenue. It's one of the concerns that I've heard out there. So, and by doing this and bringing it back into a general fund and allowing the Small Business Advocate Office to then use that to help out with companies that may have found themselves in a position that is undesirable and their first time, that seems to be a good way to take the adversarial role off of our government agencies and make them a little bit more friendly.
Mr. Chair, we're rotating. The new Mr. Chair. I guess I'm wondering then, Representative Kreisch, if you're going to encourage each of these divisions to relook at their budget and propose an amount that to fill the gap, because I'm thinking that's what's going to happen. What they're currently spending is based on an average amount of income they come in. And I recall this from the school district. We know we get interest on the money that we have in our account, so we budget for that interest, and that interest counts as part of our budget. If they do something similar and assume a penalty amount because it's an average based on history, and they budget for that, and you're going to suddenly take that from them, they're going to have to increase their budget amount proactively in order to fill the gap that you might be causing. So I understand what you're trying to do. I think there may be an offsetting amount needed then for these divisions to be able to function as they're currently functioning. So I just wondered if you've considered that or how you might move ahead thinking like that.
Representative Kreisch.
And thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Norton. And to that, I understand that, and maybe it's a hardline approach, but if these agencies are balancing their budget on the backs of our businesses and how they get aggressive with their fining, I think then that's some policy that we need to look at. So I appreciate your comments.
Okay. Representative Barrett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and just a general comment about the bill. Representative Kreisch, I appreciate you bringing the bill to our committee. Appreciate the extensive way in which we went over the bill, and I know you have many stops to go, but I think it's pretty timely. You know, is it the final solution? It may or may not be. Well, you know, that's what the legislative process is about. But today, I think the numbers came in for December jobs, and I think from what I could tell, we lost 5,200 jobs in Minnesota in the month of December. So I think your bill is timely. I look forward to the discussion, and I look forward to getting more people employed in Minnesota. So thanks again for being to the committee.
Thank you.
Next, we have Representative Lean, and last, Representative Moran.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Kreisch, I'd like to ask you a little bit about the workforce housing section, Article 4, and I certainly invite any input from other stakeholders or partners that you worked with on that section. But my question relates around, I know this is kind of a new endeavor that we're all taking a look at, trying to look at different ways, different solutions we can address this. And I guess I'm wondering if we've taken a look at the potential effectiveness or how forming public-private partnerships through something, for example, like bonding dollars or sort of a cash match with some of these developers may compare to just the tax exemptions or tax credits when we're talking about trying to build some of these facilities.
Representative Crescia.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Lean, I'm sorry, I didn't catch the gist of your question. Can you try it again?
Yeah, no, I apologize. It's kind of drawn out. But basically just wondering, like I say, I know this is kind of a new challenge, a new endeavor we're all trying to address. And if you or any folks you've worked with have taken a look at trying to meet the demands of workforce housing through more public-private partnerships through the state, for example, some bonding dollars or something there where the state can meet halfway on the front end versus some of the tax credits or tax deductions on the back end for some of these developers.
Mr. Crescia.
And thank you for that. And I think I understand your question now, Representative Lean. We've started to look at that, and as I said early on, this is a framework bill. There'll be lots of traveling pieces. I believe in the public-private enterprise, and I think that's exactly what this is done at the local level. I'm trying to keep the state out of it. I'm trying to keep this and drive it down into frankly, areas north of your district. That if we can get them working directly in their local communities, to me, that seems to be the right approach. It seems like if we run this up the flagpole to the state, then I end up in more committees like this answering more of your questions. So that's the way I'm hoping this is built. I'm certainly open to other ideas, and if you have some, please let me know. And if you have groups that you'd like me to work with, I'm more than happy to do so with that.
Thank you.
Next, we have Representative Moran.
Mr. Chair, Representative. I'm really interested in Article 5 and looking at the tax credits. And within the bill, it states that a qualified economic development region is an economic development region. Can you explain to us what is an economic development region?
Representative Crescia.
Yes, and thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Moran, for the question. There's a map that you will have that will talk about some of these qualified economic development regions, but what we're really trying to drive through here is we're trying to get to the middle class and the medium income, and that is the intent of that. I'll be honest with you, I haven't gotten fully into all the specifics of it, but it certainly is driving into what we consider to be helping bring up the middle class and medium income areas. If you'd like more on that, I can follow up with that. I'd be more than happy to do so.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
So I have maybe a couple of questions. Do we have enough time for that?
Well, we're going to have to go at 2:30. Yeah. Representative Mahoney has a question, too.
Well, I've asked more than my share.
Go ahead.
Okay, just one other question, and it's just a defining question. What does job vacancy mean?
Representative Crescia.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And job vacancy, where did you see that? Right in the bill?
Yes, also on the tax credit.
Do you know which page that is?
I'm looking at page 35. Let's see. I'm hoping. Okay.
And if I could, Mr. Chair, I'd like to call to phone a friend and ask the researchers to come out. Make sure I get that correct.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Chair, Representative Moran, that is a de-defined term. I assume, I don't know exactly what it refers to, but I assume it's that employers have posted jobs that they have not been able to fill for some period of time. I'm not sure what the duration would be. We'd have to find out from the data folks at DEED what exactly it takes to qualify as a vacancy in their data.
Mm. So. And Mr. Okay. Chair? And just a quick follow-up to that, and thank you, to the research staff. As Representative Mahoney and Representative Norton and others have highlighted, this is the beginning, and I know we've all worked on these, and we have to start somewhere. And, of course, getting to the heart of how we're going to actually define these, there's lots of ways to get to some of these metrics. And I'm open to those of you that have had experience, if you have ideas you'd like to bring to me or help me get to better indicators of many of these, I'm very open to that.
And just one really other short question, because I'm really interested in tax credits in other ways, too. But you also stated that a student would get a tax credit up to 5 years, right? Does that happen if they decide to move within 6 months or after 6 months?
Mr. Chair, this we've focused on this flaw in the credit, and we have an amendment drafted to do a variety of things to the bill, and that's is one of the things to essentially take the tax. It's not in the language now, but there will be a provision added that takes the tax credit away if the individual moves out of the qualified economic development region.
And if I could, Mr. Chair, just a final comment. I think by the number of opposition that we had today, what we have is a broad agreement on many of these concepts. And so I would invite you and the committee members to help me move this forward. Help me fix some of these areas. I know there are going to be ongoing conversations in many legislative sessions, but I think if we keep trying to move forward, I think it benefits the whole state.
Thank you very much. With that, we'll lay this bill over, and we are adjourned. Thank you for your help.